The sermon I decided to give today, I actually gave in Milwaukee, I think, a version of this about 14 years ago. And as I recall, no one threw anything at me, so I wanted to take some of the better points, I think, of that sermon and kind of rework them and give it another version of it today. If you saw in the bulletin, the title is this Lessons of Noah. Years ago, I used to subscribe to several different newsletters. And again now, 15, 16 years ago, one of the newsletters I received had a kind of a whimsical thing in it, but it was entitled Noah's 10 Lessons, which was the title of the sermon I gave so many years ago. But you might have read that lesson too, and at first I was pretty amused by it. And then as I read it again, I started thinking about it. I said, there's some really deep points in this sermon. And I wanted to share with you 10 lessons from Noah's Ark. And again, I've come up with a couple of extras I think will make us think and drawn some different conclusions from some of the previous points. But I hope as we go through them that they help us truly, you know, understand and remember the important lessons from that event and how they do apply to us today. So let's start, obviously, over in Genesis. One of the things I did last time I gave this sermon is I spent a lot of time in Genesis, which made the sermon a little long. So we will kind of do a little review here today. But the story of Noah's Ark is one that most of us have known all our life. And I remember as a child, I think my first exposure to the story, because we did not attend church, was in a doctor's waiting room. And if you remember, in doctor's waiting room, they may still have them, but they had these children's illustrated Bible. And this is a long time ago, so they were, I don't know when they were written, but they were in color even. So it hasn't, you know, been that long ago. But I remember seeing that, and they took liberties, obviously, but I can still envision in my mind, at least according to what that children's illustrated Bible, I know what Adam and Eve looked like because they told me. I think they also had a picture of Christ that's unfortunately still in my mind because that's not what he looked like. But I remember that. And obviously, they don't know what, you know, but what I found in that story of in Adam and Eve as I read it, it helped me as a youngster with, you know, just envisioning that serpent coming down and being around, you know, and convincing Eve to, yeah, eat this apple. It's good for you. It'll be fine. But it made it very real to me. And also, I remember it was the same with the story of Noah's Ark. And I can remember still that ark, that picture of that ark drawing, perched there on a little mound with all of the animals, you know, stretching out as far as you can see to the horizon. You know, just coming in an orderly fashion, coming two by two. And as a child, I was very intrigued, you know, by this story. It helped make it real to me. But let's turn to Genesis 6, and let's just review this just a bit. I want to review this before I get into the points. So Genesis 6, again, you can follow along if you'd like. You know, the first verses 1 through 5 really start talking about God starting to see the wickedness in man. Okay, verse 6, he states something that I can't imagine, you know, at this point, what he's thinking or what he's feeling. Understanding now how much God loves people, his people and his creation. But he said in verse 6, he said, the Lord was very sorry that he had made man on earth, and he was grieved in his heart. Again, what little we do understand of God's character, it seems to be totally against what he would think. But can you imagine what he's feeling at this point? If he's saying he's sorry that he even made man, you know, what a terrible feeling for him. Verse 7, we see he vowed to destroy man from the face of the earth. Verse 8, just to review a few things here, we see that Noah, though, found grace in the eyes of the Lord. We'll come back and talk about that a little bit. Verse 9, it talks about the genealogy a bit. You know, Noah talks about here was a just man. It says he's perfect and his generations, and that he walked with God. And I would love someday, if my story is ever told, I would love it to say, Joe walked with God. And I obviously have a lot of work to do. Verse 10, Noah begot three sons, Shem, Ham, Japheth. We know this story. Verse 11, and the earth was corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with violence. Does that not sound a little bit like the world we live in today? Here, beginning in verse 12, so God looked upon the earth, and indeed it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. And God said to Noah, verse 13, the end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them, and behold, I will destroy them with the earth. And then verse 14, and we'll come back and review some of this in the points, but verse 14, he gives Noah some very detailed and comprehensive instructions. He says, make yourself an ark of gopher wood. Make rooms in the ark and cover it inside and outside with pitch. And again, he tells him, and this is how you'll make it. He gives him the exact dimensions. The ark shall be 300 cubits long, its width 50, its height 30 cubits. Again, very detailed instruction. He just doesn't say, go build a big boat. You're going to need it. Right? He says in verse 16, you shall make a window for the ark, and you shall finish it to a cubit from above, and set the door of the ark on its side. You shall make it with lower, second, and third decks. You see, he told them exactly what to do. He's again saying, do as I say. Verse 17, and behold, I myself am bringing a floodwaters on the earth to destroy from under heaven all flesh in which is the breath of life. Everything that is on the earth shall die. Going on then in 18, but I will establish, he's telling Noah, I will establish my covenant with you. You shall go into the ark, you, your sons, and your wives' sons with you, and every living thing of all flesh. You shall bring two of every sort into the ark to keep them alive with you, and they shall be male and female. And again, he's giving him specifics of the birds of their kind, of the animals after their kind, and of every creeping thing of the earth after its kind. Two of every kind will come to you, and you to keep them alive. And you shall take for yourself all food that is eaten, and you shall gather it to yourself, and it shall be food for you and them. In verse 22, we don't hear Noah saying, this sounds kind of like a big story here. That's a lot of work. What we see, we know Noah walked with God. Verse 22, what's it say? Thus Noah did, according to all that God commanded him, so he did. Right? God picked him. Right? He picked him because he was a just man, and now God has laid out this enormous task for him. And I have to put myself in that position. I love God, and I try to follow him, but Noah didn't ask, what are you talking about? Are you sure? That sounds pretty extreme, God. He didn't. He didn't say, that's a lot. What we read is, he did it. Just as the Lord commanded him. He did according to what God told him to do. Let's look over at verse chapter 7. Again, a little bit of review. You know, as an overview. In verse 2, we see Noah is told to bring in seven pair of clean animals and one pair of the unclean. Verse 3, seven pairs of each bird. Verse 4 and 5, he tells them then that, Noah, it's going to rain for 40 days and 40 nights, and I will destroy everything out there. Verse 6, Noah was 600 years old when the flood happened. And we'll talk about that a little bit more later. Reviewing verses 7 through 10, Noah does what God says, right? He takes his family into the ark. He follows God's instructions. He does exactly as he was asked. Verses 11 and 12, we can see that the flood starts, and just as God had said, it rains for 40 days and 40 nights, not 39 and a half, not 50. It was 40 days and 40 nights. And verse 20, and this is, again, hard to imagine, he describes the overwhelming depth of the water. He says, the waters prevailed 15 cubits upward, and the mountains were covered. Think about that. Were the mountains the same height they are now? I don't know. But they were mountains, right? They were covered, and that's hard to fathom today. Verses 22 through 23, it tells us again here that everything not on the ark dies. God's promise and what he told Noah was fulfilled. Verse 24, and the water prevailed on the earth 150 days. If we look at chapter 8 then, we can start to see that, you know, it talks about that time when the waters then start to recede. And in verse 5, I lost my place. Yeah, verse 5, you know, it talks about now we're finally starting to see just the tops of the mountains as they are being exposed. Reviewing verses 7 through 12, we see the process of him first sending out that raven and then that series of doves to hopefully eventually bring back some evidence that there is dry land. And then we see here in verses 13 and 14, finally, the earth was dried up, the ark was opened, and we know the rest of that story. And we also know that from there, from that point, the survivors, man and animals, were told that they were to scatter and they were to be fruitful and they were to multiply. And we know that's exactly what happened. And while we could spend so much time here on each verse and pick out countless lessons, I do have 10 lessons that we're going to talk about today. And let's just start with the first one. And I used this one in this sermon 14 years ago. And the first lesson from Noah simply is to plan ahead. Right? Plan ahead, because it wasn't raining when Noah built the ark. Think about that. Plan ahead. Let's go back to Proverbs 6 real quick. Proverbs chapter 6, I think, would be a great place to start as we build our case to support this first lesson. Proverbs 6, starting in verse 6. And again, we all know we should plan ahead. And some of us aren't as good as that at others. Sometimes we wait till the last minute to do whatever, to pack for a trip, to prepare a sermon, to do whatever. But God tells us, plan ahead. Proverbs 6, verse 6. Again, it tells us to look to the ant for inspiration, basically as an example of how you and I should prepare for the future. Verse 6, it says, go to the ant, you sluggard. Consider her ways and be wise. Having no captain, overseer, or ruler, provides her supplies in the summer and gathers her food in the harvest. Verse 9, how long will you slumber, O sluggard? When will you rise up from your sleep? A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to sleep. Verse 11, so shall your poverty come on you like a prowler and your need like an armed man. I'm not saying anything new at all that you don't know. That we have to be prepared both physically and spiritually for when the trials come, because as sure as rain, they're going to come. We can't wait until we're in the midst of that trial and then say, I've got to get myself ready. Where's that go bag that I wanted to put together or whatever? We have to be ready. Every day we live, we know that we're closer and closer to the end times. We don't know when it is. We can speculate, right? Only God knows that day. But brethren, you and I, and I probably going forward in many messages, I'm in talking to people, I'm starting to see people with a sense of urgency. And I want that sense of urgency in myself. So we'll probably talk about that more. But in relating to that, today now, brethren, is our time to prepare for that and for the end times. And we can say, well, it's not a really good time right now in my life. I'm working too many hours. You know, I have a new girlfriend, and we're trying to spend some time together to get to know each other. I don't know what the story is. I have excuses sometimes. But again, please understand, today is our time to prepare for the end of times, to do our best every day to make God a priority, live a life pleasing to Him, right? To grow closer to Him right now, not when things calm down a little bit. I've said that many times in my life. And what it is an excuse. It's not, I haven't made it a priority, right? How about you? Again, as this lesson says, it wasn't raining when Noah built the ark. Right? He planned for it, and we need to do the same. Turn back to Luke 17, if you would, please. Luke 17 reminds me of today, this world we live in. Luke 17, verses 26 and under 27. If we try to understand, that is, what it was like in the days of Noah, and that God had just had it. And in our little minds, as compared to God's, doesn't this seem that he's talking about today? Could be. But verses 26 and 27 of Luke 17 says, "And as it was in the days of Noah, so will it be in the days of the Son of Man. They ate, they drank, they married wives, they were given in marriage until the day Noah entered the ark and the flood came and destroyed them all." Again, back in Genesis 6, which we read a bit but skipped over, Genesis 6, verse 11. Let's look at that. Genesis is here. Okay, there. Genesis 6, verse 11. It says, "The earth also was corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with violence." Again, doesn't that sound familiar? We know it was the case in Noah's time. Going on in verse 12, he says, "So God looked upon the earth, and indeed it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. And God said to Noah," verse 13, "The end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them, and behold, I will destroy them with the earth." As I read this verse occasionally and I think about it, I have to ask myself, was he more disgusted with the way it was then than he is now? I don't know, but it's something to think. I can't ever answer that, obviously. Most of the time when I read the scriptures and kind of compare it to today's society and the condition that we're in, especially as we consider what it's going to be like prior to the return of Christ, I have to wonder, just how bad will it be? How much worse will it get? We need to consider, brethren, what it was like during Noah's time. He knew what was going to happen. He knew that he was going to protect Noah, even though he destroyed the world. And that is exactly what he's planning for you and I. The world will come to an end as we know it. And he's basically telling you and I the same thing he told Noah. I will save you. All you have to do is follow these directions. That's it. Think about it. I mean, I'm simplifying a bit because we know following those directions isn't always easy for us thick-headed humans at times. But he's telling us the same thing he told Noah. I'm going to destroy it. Do what I ask. You'll be saved. Let's read Genesis 6, starting in verse 14. It says, "Make yourself an ark of gopher wood. Make rooms in the ark." We read this earlier. "And cover it inside and outside with pitch." And again, he told him, I want it to be exactly this long. I want it this high, this wide. I want three decks. He went through it all. I wanted to have a window here. I wanted to have pitch inside and outside. Basically saying, don't take any shortcuts. Do it the way that I said. And what happened? Verse 22, we read this. Thus Noah did according to all that God commanded him, so he did. So the question I'll ask at this point in the sermon is, are you actively building your spiritual ark today? God's given you all the directions. It's laid out in your Bible. Are we actively building that ark? Or are we saying, I think we have a little more time. I think after the end of this year, things are going to lighten up. And I'm really going to give it everything I have. Maybe I'm the only one here who has said, I'll get to that Bible study when I have a chance. I'll do that when I have more time. Again, God has told us basically the same thing he told Noah. There is a storm coming, and it's going to be really bad. But if you follow my directions, you don't have to worry about it. Right? He's told us what to do, how we're supposed to live, how we're to treat others, how we should obey him, how we're supposed to live, how we're to treat others, etc., right? Are we doing as Noah did in verse 22, right? It says he did everything that God commanded him. Are we doing that today? Or are we saying, well, you know, God, I've go for wood. Are you sure go for wood? That's hard to cut. It's kind of expensive. It's really hard to work with. You know, pine would be cheaper. Much easier to cut, much easier to work with. Are we reasoning with God? Right? Are we saying, and what do you mean pitch inside and out? I think if we just do it on the outside and put extra on the outside, we should be fine. Again, it's a little humorous, but think about it. Isn't that how we are as humans? We question God by not doing exactly as he says. We kind of make it that, well, this is a little easier path. Because that other way is kind of hard. That's a lot of work. Think about it this way. If God's spiritual instructions to us were like the plans for building the ark, would our spiritual ark float when we're done with it? Would it float when we're done? Would we follow God's plans? Would we do it just as he said? Make it more real. Are we following God's plans for us today? Or are you like probably all of us in this room, do we say, take shortcuts sometimes? So point number one is simply this: plan ahead, because it wasn't raining when Noah built the ark. Point number two: stay fit. When you're 600 years old, someone might ask you to do something really big. What am I saying here? Well, I'm saying, first of all, that you're never too old to be of service to God. And also, you're never too young to be of service to God. You know, we know that we have to make efforts every day to try to remain as physically and spiritually healthy as we can, so that we're ready when God really needs us. And even when we think about, you know, we chuckle about Noah being 600 years old, you know, at the time of the flood, we understand that Noah was well into middle age at this point, at 600 years old. And I never realized it, but looking back in Genesis again, 6 again, a point I never really processed, let's look at this in verse 3. Genesis 6, verse 3, the Lord said, my spirit shall not strive with man forever, for he is indeed flesh, yet his days shall be 120 years. So basically saying it from this point forward, he's kind of limiting man's life, that people are going to live 120 years, and but most importantly, he's saying that people have 120 years to live from this point. I guess is the point I want to make, because that's when the flood's coming. Right? They had 120 years to change his ways. And though it doesn't explicitly say it, there are many commentaries that say that it is at this point when Noah started building the ark. Genesis 7, verse 6. And then it says here, so Noah was 600 years old when the floodwaters came upon the earth. So if we do a little simple math, we know that it took Noah 120 years to build the ark, and that he was 480 years old when he started. Genesis 5, verse 32. How old was Noah when he begat Shem, Ham, and Japheth? Genesis 5, verse 32. And Noah was 500 years old, and begot Noah. And Noah begot Shem, Ham, and Japheth. So all of you parents who have teenagers now, and you're wore out by them, and you are maybe 50, in your 40s, he didn't have them until he was 500, which again is pretty interesting. But again, at this time, understand, most people had their children in their mid to late 100s. So he was up there, you know, even for having children. They weren't spring chickens at this time. Genesis 6, verse 18, again, we'll look at this. When God talked to Noah, you know, he may have not had thought he was never going to have children, but God had other plans. Genesis 6, verse 18. He said, I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall go into the ark, you, your sons, your wife, and your sons' wives with you. Think about that. This is when he was 480 years old, and when God's telling him this, did I misspeak? Oh, no. God's telling him this. He must have been thinking, I don't have any sons. I'm getting up there. Right? He had something to look forward to. And I think to add to this point number two, I guess I need to say that, and I mentioned this, that we're never too young to do God's work. We have the teen club people here today. This is the church is your future. You are the future of the church. What's my third point then? Point number three. Don't listen to critics. Do what has to be done. We know that God has a very special calling for us, and we need to make sure that we don't allow others to divert us from that calling. No one should, again, be able to steal our crown. Think about that story of Noah, you know, and think back to that time, that 120 years that he spent building the ark. And we've heard sermons, and we just know that he endured a lot of heckling. Hey, you crazy old man, what's the boat for? You know, you're building a boat in the middle of nowhere. You know, I could just imagine. You know, do something productive, will you? I'm sure people were making fun of him for that whole 120 years, but it didn't change what he was doing. He didn't swerve from his calling. How many of us in this room have been ridiculed at some point for what you believe? Probably many of us, right? You've been ridiculed for what you believe and for doing the right thing. You know, and I have people all the time, you know, around Christmas. Now, why is it you don't keep Christmas? I said, well, if you really want to know. And I tell them, and they say, well, okay, whatever. You know, Merry Christmas as they walk away, you know. But a lot of people, we understand, they may be polite enough to listen to us, but they don't believe us. They probably think we're a little kooky. And there's often some ridicule there, if not to our face, behind our back. Noah endured that for 120 years. And it never caused him to deviate from his plan. You guys remember the infamous former Minnesota governor, Jesse the Body Ventura. Bigger than life in so many ways. But he said this one time on television. I wrote this down then. I'll use it, but I want to say it. He said this. I think it was on the Bill Maher show. He said, organized religion is a sham. And it's a crutch for the weak-minded people who need strength in numbers. And again, this was on national TV. The people that were with him, they talked about that people who need organized religion are just leaning on that as a crutch. Do you believe that? That's not what God tells us, right? As he says to us, don't listen to the critics. Build your ark. Do it this way. Live this way. Do as I say. Let's look at this example. 1 Corinthians. Right? God has called you and I. 1 Corinthians chapter 1. And he expects us to do what has to be done. 1 Corinthians 1. I'll start in verse 22. 1 Corinthians 1, starting in verse 22. For Jews request a sign, and Greeks seek after wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified, to the Jews a stumbling block, and to the Greeks foolishness. Verse 24, but to those who are called both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God. Verse 25, because the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. And finally, going on here, verse 26, for you see your calling, brethren, that not many wise according to the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called. But God has chosen the foolish things of the world to put to shame the wise, and God has chosen the weak things of the world to put to shame the things which are mighty. All of those people ridiculing us, talking down about religious people. Verse 28, and the base things of the world and the things which are despised, God has chosen, and the things which are not, to bring to nothing the things that are, that no flesh should glory in his presence, but of him you are in Christ Jesus, who became for us wisdom from God, and righteousness, and sanctification, and redemption. And verse 31, he who glories, let him glory in the Lord. We know and are deep in our hearts that God has personally handpicked each of us in this room. Why did he choose me? Why did he choose you? Only he knows, right? It talks about how he picks the weak and the base things. But he chose us. He picked you, and we need to remember that God has picked us, and he's given us specific instructions. Don't let anyone ever steal your crown. As point three says, don't listen to the critics. Do what you have to do, what has to be done. We know what that is, right? It's not a secret. It's not hidden. God has told us, this is what you need to do. Don't listen to anyone else. Prove it to yourself. Follow me. Follow my directions here. So what is the fourth point from the lesson of Noah? I guess it's water. Fourth point from the lessons of Noah is simply build on high ground. Each of us will face many floods, and we need to make sure that we stay out of those floodplains. Right? Build on high grounds. I remember back in Illinois where I lived about 35 miles west of the Mississippi River. And every year, without fail, the Mississippi would get out of its banks, and there'd be these huge floods. And you read stories. I actually would go over and help with sandbags as a young kid, but you talk to people, you read stories about this as their second, third, fourth, 15th time in the last 20 years that our house has been flooded. And I remember as a youngster when I was down there, I'd think, why don't they just move? Now, I understand.
Excuse me.
I understand that moving may have been a lot easier said than done for this, but I remember thinking, why do you keep doing this? You know it's going to happen. I would have thought at that time that they'd learned the first time that they shouldn't live there. But again, the point is we need to be smart, and we look at the spiritual sense. We need to build, as it tells us, on high ground, not stay out of those floodplains, stay out of those areas, and make sure that our foundation, our spiritual foundation, is on high ground. Let's look at Matthew 7. All right, Christ told us that if we do that, that we could withstand any storm if we follow him and if we do the things that he tells us to. We should be able to withstand any storm if we follow him and do the things he tells us. Matthew 7, verse 24 simply says this. It says, that's wrong. Matthew 7, verse 24. Okay, here we go. Verse 24, Matthew 7, therefore, whoever who hears these sayings of mine and does them, again, that's the secret, right? That's the key part. Who hears them and does them, I will liken him to a wise man who builds his house on a rock. Verse 25, and the rain descended, the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on that house, and it did not fall, for it was founded on the rock. Going on in verse 26, but everyone who hears these sayings of mine and does not do them will be like a foolish man who built his house in the sand. Again, like that guy who built his house down on the Mississippi River floodplains. And is he just looking for trouble? He says in verse 27, and the rain descended, the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on that house, and it fell. And great was its fall. Again, this isn't new to us. We've heard this. We try to live by it. But we still should ask ourselves, again, are we building our foundation on a high ground? Are we building it on the rock? Because if we do, if we follow God's instruction as he promised us here, if we do that, no matter what happens, we can look at all the turmoil going on around us, and it would not affect us, and we can see that it won't affect us. Right? We're told we need to work out our own salvation. We understand that. That's who we are, but we have to make sure our foundation is solid first and that we're obeying God and what he's telling us to do. So if we haven't yet finished our foundation, our solid foundation on high ground, on that rock, let's move to that high ground now because time's wasting. Point number five that I have for you today in the lessons of Noah is speed isn't always an advantage. The cheetahs were on board, but so were the snails. And think about that. We all run the same race, right? We all run the same race. Some might run faster than others, but the most important thing we've been told all our lives, all the time we've been in church, is to finish the race. That our race isn't a sprint. It's an endurance, right? Race. It's a marathon. Hebrews 12. Again, is very familiar scripture to many of us that talks about this specifically. Hebrews 12, verse 1. As we turn over there and consider that speed isn't always an advantage. Hebrews 12, verse 1. It says, therefore, we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. God clearly tells us this is going to be a while. You need to settle in, get your pace. You need to always be moving forward. And we can't start fast with lots of zeal and get to that point in our life where we're saying, it's too much. I'm tired now. I've known people, you have too, who've gotten to that point and they just said, I'm exhausted. I just can't do this anymore. And they've walked away. Brethren, we can't do that. We can't lose our zeal. We can't lose our energy, because our race is one that requires steady forward progress. Even just standing still isn't okay, because we're losing ground. We don't have time to stand still. We have to have a constant forward movement. Point number five is speed isn't always an advantage. My sixth point today from the lessons of Noah is simply this: for safety's sake, travel in pairs. Two heads are better than one. What do I mean by that? Turn back to Ecclesiastes chapter 4. Ecclesiastes chapter 4. We're going to see here, this is where Solomon talks about the importance of friendship and how one can strengthen another in time of need. And he talks about, as we're going to be turning over to verse 8, he talks about the need for us to strive to build good, solid friendships so we can help each other. Ecclesiastes 4, let's start in verse 8. It says, "There is one alone without companion. He has neither son nor brother, yet there is no end to all his labors. Nor is his eye satisfied with riches, but he never asks, 'For whom do I toil and deprive myself of goods?' This is also vanity and grave misfortune." Verse 9. "Two are better than one, because they have a good reward for their labor. Verse 10, "For if they fall, one will lift up his companion. But woe to him who is alone when he falls, for he has no one to help him up." Verse 11, again, "If two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one be warm alone? Though one may be overpowered by another." In verse 12, "Two can withstand him, and a threefold cord is not quickly broken." What he's reminding us of is that we need each other. Simply put, we need each other. We need to take advantage of the time we do have together. You know, I know there are some who really work to try to get to know everybody in the congregation and bring them into their homes. This is wonderful. It's just not the time on the Sabbath. It's extra time. And you and I, we need to be better at staying in contact with each other, because we're spread out. It's not like I can walk down the block and chat with you and spend time. We need each other to support each other, to encourage each other, to lift each other up, to exhort each other if necessary. And we can't overlook the value of staying close as God's people, because there are not many of us. And we only have each other, really. If you look at the fight that we're in, we're all we have really in this world is each other, and we need each other. Point 7 goes hand in hand with point 8, is don't forget, we're all in the same boat. And I think, again, that's something that we should remember always. We think about every day at all levels of our relationships, where it's in our marriage, in our family, especially here in our local congregation, even as a church as a whole. Together, we can accomplish a lot more if we're all pulling in the same direction. Right? If we're all in harness, working as a team, trying to get to that goal together, not letting anyone fall by the wayside and say, good luck, right? It's picking each other up, when they need that, and carrying them, if necessary, towards that goal that we're going to. We know that Satan is working hard on God's church. For years, we've seen that. We know since God's church existed. We know some of the tactics Satan's tried in the past. Let's just change doctrine. Right? He won't do that again because we wouldn't fall for it. But he's thrown other obstacles up, and we've had different people leave for different reasons because they weren't able to stay with us, right? To be a part of that team. And Satan's going to work harder than ever. Think about this. We know what God expects of us as individuals. I was in Cincinnati this week, and I had a really good conversation with one of our leaders there. And he said to me, and we all know it's true, not only as a church as a whole in our local congregation. He said, "Joe, we don't always treat each other as Christ would expect us to." I'm like, that's true. And I think back to the times when I haven't. What's my excuse? Well, they ticked me off. I don't know. What was my excuse? I don't have an excuse. We know what God expects of us as individuals, right? If everyone in the United Church of God just adhered to this principle, that we're all in the same boat, that we're all trying to get to the same place, right? We know we are. Just consider this for a minute. If we, all of us, remembered that and adhered to that principle, that one principle, things would be different. They'd be better, right? They would be a lot better than they are now, because we need to understand, again, we're going to the same place. That's our goal. Let's work together. Let's understand, as this point number 7 is, we are all in the same boat. All right, point 8, and this is one I used before. And remember, Mr. Chance even commented. I wrote down his comment. But remember this. This is the point. Remember that amateurs built the Ark and professionals built the Titanic. And I like that. Mr. Chance may not remember, but afterwards he says, remember, no, the head architect of the Ark project was God. I said, oh, man, that's a really good point. Right? He was a professional. I get that. But there are two things I want to point out from this statement. Number one is that we need not be intimidated from not accomplishing what God has set before us. We need not be intimidated, because God tells us, right? He says, if God is for us, who can be against us? And sub point number two is that we need not put faith in what the world says is the truth or what is infallible. Right? Remember the verse we read back, we won't turn there, back in 1 Corinthians 1:27, it said, God has chosen the foolish of the world to put to shame the wise, and God has chosen the weak things of the world to put to shame the things which are mighty. And as I think about this point, again, where amateurs built the Ark and professionals built the Titanic, it made me look up some information, and I'll read it to you. We understand this. You might have read it before. The Titanic, it says, was constructed in Belfast, Ireland, by the building firm Harland and Wolff. And we know from history that she was the technical marvel of that time. The Titanic was built unsinkable, as they say. It had double hull, had a double bottom, it had 16 airtight compartments, and 15 watertight bulkheads running across the ship's hull. And right before that ship sailed, the president of the White Star Line, Bruce Ismay, said this as it was setting sail from Southampton. You guys have read this, you've heard it. He said, even God couldn't sink that ship. Now again, my little brain, I don't believe in tempting God. My little brain, I have to think God sitting up there going, did you hear what he said? Yeah, I don't want to dismiss God and how he works, but I don't know, but understand, that ship sunk not long after that. Remember, amateurs built the ark. Professionals built the Titanic. And again, my point is again, we need to not be intimidated from accomplishing the work that God has set before us, even though he calls the foolish and weak things. Because if we do that, we know, as they've said, we know the end of the story, right? We win. Right? We will prevail. Point number 9. Remember that the woodpeckers inside the ship are often bigger than the storm outside. And the point is that a little hole can sink a big ship. We understand that if it's not repaired. But the point that we can take to heart is, brethren, looking at this, is that we have to look at ourselves every day, right? Not just at annually at atonement, but we look at ourselves every day and we examine ourselves to be sure that our spiritual ship hasn't sprung a leak. Just that little leak, and that's not a big deal. I get to that some point, right? If we're going to make this, we have to strive to illuminate, right, any weakness that we have that could be a fatal error. If we look back at this, the instructions that God gave Noah, there's some interesting caveats here. In Genesis 6:14, remember he told him, I'll read it to you. He says, make yourself an ark of gopher wood. Make rooms in the ark and cover it inside and out with pitch. Now, this is an interesting point. And I used this many years ago in the sermon, but it's worth repeating. We'll digress a bit here. In Genesis 6:14, when he first uses that word pitch, right, that's Strong's number 3732. And it refers to the word, I don't know how to pronounce it, K-A-P-H-A-R, Kafar. But it literally means to cover. And in all places, again, to cover completely. That's the first use of it. It also means to make an atonement for, which is the other way this word is used. To figuratively, it says, to appease, to atone, to purge, to reconcile. And so this second time that the word pitch is used in Genesis 6:14, it's Strong's number 3724, and it's kopher, K-O-P-H-E-R, and it means as a ransom, as a satisfaction, as a price for your life. Now think about that. Think about what the literal and the figurative meanings are here. So as I read this, I see just the pitch, again, made the ark watertight. It's not going to leak. But as we consider these two different uses of this word, there are a picture of Christ. Right? Christ as our atonement, as it's talking about how the pitch is used inside the person or inside the vessel, right? And on the outside, Christ as our redemption. Right? Those in the ark were saved because the pitch protected them from the death outside. So too are people that Christ has protected. I think it's an interesting study if you look into that a little bit more, because there's some other comments in the concordance that draw some other interesting parallels. But the last point I want to share with you today, I think, is most important of all. And it simply is this. No matter how bleak it looks, if God is with you, there's always a rainbow on the other side. And sometimes I wonder, again, in my little mind, if Noah ever worried during the flood. If he ever worried. I'm sure those 40 days and 40 nights of rain were nerve-wracking, especially when you had a lot of animals that you got to take care of, and you're wondering, is it really going to be 40 days? How many days has it been? I just have to wonder what was going through his mind. And then it was another 150 days before the water even started to recede. And so I asked myself, understanding Noah was deeply converted, more than I think, did he ever have a doubt? It's not recorded for us. But I wonder, did he ever have a doubt? Was there ever a worry in his mind during this time? I'm going to guess not. But the lesson for you and I is that we need to remember that no matter how fierce the storm is, no matter how long it rages, God says that if we do what he asks, that he will deliver us. We understand it may not be in this life. This life is temporary. We get that. But he will deliver us. And I'm sure that Noah's hope at some point had to be tried just a bit. But like Noah, we need to keep our hope in God. Because again, no matter how bleak it looks, if we're obeying God, if God is with you there, as it says in my point, there's always a rainbow on the other side. So those are the 10 lessons I wanted to share with you today on Noah and the Ark. And I hope that they're worth remembering. I hope that you look back on them and dig into some of them a little deeper. But to conclude, I would leave you with this. You and I need to remember to prepare now for the storms ahead because they're coming. And we need to remember that no matter how fierce that storm looks, no matter how fierce that storm becomes, that if we build our house on high ground, if we build our spiritual ark to the specification that God has given us, we will remain safe and God will deliver us.